If you have the timetable, you can see roughly what we're going to do. We will look at the Bible in this first session. Then we will open, I hope, a significant amount of time between spouses, particularly. The real goal of this day is that spouses can have conversations that they have been putting off all year or all decade. Actually, that doesn't work, does it, this year? It's a new decade. But for a while, those conversations with your spouse or with other Christian friends who support you as parents. I want to start actually by saying that I know there are several single parents here with us today. I know there'll be other couples where there's only one of the parents here. That that is my entire experience of childhood. So my father fell ill, seriously ill, almost the moment I was born. I'm told it was not necessarily my fault, but that's what happened. And he died when I was two, and my mother, from that point on, was a single parent. And that is just my entire knowledge of what it is like to be a child and be brought up. She was a teacher working. She had a small child, me. She had a teenager as well, and was an astonishing, excellent parent through all of that. So we will talk today about couples, about husbands and wives, because that is where the Bible encourages us to start. But if you are here on your own for whatever reason, please don't hear that as a criticism from the church or anything other than support and encouragement. So first morning will be a Bible talk, first session Bible talk, followed by the real goal, which is that the very obvious things I have said will give you permission then to talk about that with whoever you are sitting with. And then after that, after coffee, we have a range of people coming to talk on a range of topics. We made a list of all the hot button topics that we might want to cover on a day about parenting, and the list was so long that I could just read it to you and then we would go home. And so we have some people we'll introduce later who very kindly agreed to come and give us a start on a number of different topics. And what we'll do is they will give us a topic and then we'll break again into couples or other groupings to talk about what they have just said. As we begin, I want to just lay out three features I think are in the background when we talk about parenting, three features that clash painfully and make parenting difficult. There is the pressure and stress at the moment on children, and on teenagers, maybe in particular, which is what children turn into, I'm afraid to tell you. And in particular, the sort of mental health outcomes, all the statistics at the moment, the pressure that is on children, that's one thing. The other is the enormous volume of quick fix, silver bullet options for children that is around at the moment. The books of the W.H. Smiths is lined with things that will magically transform the lives of our children. And then I think third, there is enormous pressure on parents to succeed and succeed visibly. Oh, look at the parents. You know, what did they do wrong? Or haven't we done well? Those pressures. And sadly, I think that being a Christian can make all three of those pressures worse. So to be a Christian child is now to be at school in a minority, at school and in all the various social groups. So you are placing your child in a minority status. I think that the quick fix instinct very easily comes wrapped in a sort of Bible wrapper. You know, here is the obvious Bible silver bullet. How could you not do that? And then similarly, the pressure on parents, I think that gives a whole load of extra guilt, doesn't it? You know, why are you not the perfect, loving Christian family? Why did you not do the obvious Bible Christian bullet thing that we only thought of 5 minutes ago and no one knew about when your children were the correct age for it? If you've not been under those kind of pressures, then that's great. I remember one particular group of friends where just there was a particular way you had to do the discipline of your children, and it was enormously prescriptive. There was a script you had to follow. There was the things that you had to say. There was the thing you had to do to your child. There was the thing that your child had to say back to you afterwards. Like, good luck with that. And this was just obviously what the Bible said. And if you didn't do that, you didn't love your child. And all of those pressures, I think, are not great given the messy reality of raising children. For reasons that I'm not going to go into, I happened to see a deputy head teacher yesterday who is also a parent himself, and he said, this is what parenting is. This is just what raising a child is like, he said. For his experience, for whatever it was that we were there for, that is just what it is like. So what I want to do is turn to the Bible. Please turn to page 1178. I hope you have a handout. I hope you have a handout. People are roughly nodding or not complaining anyway. Good. And if you have a pen, then you can at least write the Bible verses in as we go through. Does anyone not have a handout that wants one? One at the front and one at the back there. One at the front still and one on the side here. Too late to give one to your own wife. That's great. And let me read Ephesians 6, verses 1 to 4. Ephesians 6, verses 1 to 4 on page 1178. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And if you just keep a finger there and turn the page to Colossians, a few pages further on, page 1185. And you can see verse 20, verse 21 is very similar. Obey in everything is an extension. Pleases the Lord is a different reason. Fathers, don't provoke with a different reason, lest they become discouraged. But it's very, very similar. And that is the New Testament material on parenting. There it is. That is the, you could go to the shelf full of books and you could put them all in a shopping trolley and push them in the street and paste up that on the shelf. And that is the New Testament material on child rearing. And it is wonderful, isn't it? There is a responsibility there for children. In Ephesians, obey your parents. There are two verses of reasons for the children. They obviously think they need some reasons to obey people like us. This is right. It's there in the law. It's there as the first commandment with a promise. And then there is one responsibility for fathers and what they are to do. And at first glance, maybe that seems like very little New Testament material on this issue that seems of such huge felt importance to us. But that is to miss the whole rest of Ephesians. So children here are not sort of flapping loose in a list of things to do. Children are set in families. They are cared for by marriages. The marriage here gets 11 verses, which is roughly three times more than we get on children. They are set in households, they are set in church families, and there is teaching here to the whole church and to every single Christian, and that gives us, I think, a sense of the relative importance here, and I think sometimes our stresses are entirely the wrong way around. There's one verse on how actually you should raise your children. There are 11 verses on how husbands and wives should treat each other. Suggests that maybe what our children most need is for us to treat each other in the way the Bible tells us to. That's what we most need. Pay attention to our marriages. And then there are 89 verses in the application section of the book, chapters 4, 5, and 6, all about how to walk worthy of the calling we've received. Suggests that what our children most need is for us to pay attention to Jesus and to our Christian character in general. So that's roughly what we're going to walk through this morning before I allow you to chat to each other about this. So point one, your child, and now that we've given away the secret, you can write on there that that is only really about 6 verse 4. One verse only, but there is quite a lot in that verse, isn't there? There is a lot covered in that verse. 6 verse 4, notice the responsibility is with fathers. It opens fathers. That is not, I don't think, prescribing who should spend what percentage of time in the home or who should earn what percentage of the household income. nor is it about who should do what with nappies or bins or who should do the sex talk or whatever it is. Husbands and wives do this together as a team, together with other people. But it's clear the responsibility and the leadership comes from the father for this. I'm not going to make stereotypes, but often there will be one person in the couple who thinks more, cares more, buys the book at the bookstall at the back and brings it home and hopes the husband will read it and however that works in your house. But the Bible is absolutely clear the responsibility and the leadership is to come from the father. The danger is very clear. Do not provoke your children to anger. In Colossians, it's do not discourage your children and how you do this. That's in the context of discipline, instruction, and obedience. And I think nailing the danger here, it's about the impression that your child gets that they are never, ever good enough, that they are always doing something wrong. And it's interesting they have that impression because, you know, if you actually ran a watch on it, quite often they are doing something wrong pretty much all of the time, aren't they? But it's discouraging. You can understand if you lead a team or anything at work, it's discouraging if someone on your team feels that they are always doing something wrong or that they're set up to fail. And in the second-by-second stress of parenting, it's very easy to do that. I think the analogy might be the difference between golf and cricket. So there are two pointless exercises that I'm very bad at, but one generates headlines yesterday about the heroes who did something amazing and how well they did, and look what however many 100 runs they got, well done them in cricket, whereas the other is just basically about today, how few mistakes did I make? And the whole scoring system and the whole, you know, well done for not making too many mistakes. Totally different approaches to life, I think, the golfer and the cricketer. You please don't complain about that analogy later. Are we discouraging our children? Are we provoking them to anger? Or are we working towards a child who wants to live for the Lord? Think about what you would do with your team, with people you were coaching, training, mentoring, and how encouraging you would be. And then the final bit of the verse, bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And both of those things, discipline and instruction, they are not PC, are they? They were not instilled in me by my liberal education, but they are both urgently needed goods for children who want to turn into adult human beings, aren't they? If you think about discipline, and remember there is lots of freedom here in how you do that. Around the room we will have different views, different things we have done, different things we have tried, lots of freedom in how you do. But that you must do it is clear here. And you think about how good the goal is that you're aiming for there. You're aiming for an adult with self-control. Again and again and again in the New Testament, the key thing, particularly to young men, be self-controlled. All of us know how difficult that is. And self-control really is freedom. The freedom to do what your best self intended to, the freedom to live for the Lord, trained in responsibility with the father, acted on by both parents together, so that your child is free when they grow up. It's a massive good. And instruction, again, that is a massive, massive good if you think that the Lord is good. If you think that the Lord wants good things for our children, if you think that a child who is more radically committed to Jesus will be a child who is in the best possible place in every way. And I think we'll talk about this a bit in the interviews and topics later. But if we avoid certain Bible areas and topics of instruction, perhaps because we're embarrassed of raising them or because we don't feel we have all the answers, or because we know that if our child repeats what we've said, it will make them seem socially odd, or it will clash with our teacher's views, or they'll get bullied. Actually, we just need to be clear that the Lord is good, that more of the Lord in our children will be good for our children. The things the Lord tells them to do are good things, good for them. So there's the one verse, and let's just underline that because there is only one verse of actual detailed prescriptive instruction, that means that the rest is not prescribed in the New Testament. I think this is an area where Christians need to keep sane heads and keep pushing back on other forces. There are other ways of developing Christian material, and it may be good advice or bad advice, but that is what it is. Even if it comes from someone with saint in front of their name who's been dead for hundreds of years, still it is Christian advice. And we are not to judge each other, criticize each other. We're not to feel guilt. There is freedom within the silences of the Bible. The things the Bible does not say we must do, there is freedom in what we will do. And we are all different personalities. Just looking around the room, we will have different cultural backgrounds. And our children are different from each other in families and from the other children around this room. And I hope as the handout goes on and we write Bible verses on there, you'll see that there is lots that matters more for our child than the stuff about children that we'd like to have written in Ephesians 6, verse 4b. I'm not saying verse 4 is the only verse that applies to us as parents. There are about, I don't know, at least half an hour or more of me talking left yet. But whether or not they eat quinoa for breakfast, whether or not they have the Mozart baby gym to stimulate their brain, you have not ruined your child's future. You are not a bad Christian if you have not done the stuff that is not in that verse. Okay, that's point one. Point two, so your child is set in a marriage. And that is verses 1 to 3 of chapter 6, and it's also chapter 5, verses 22 to 33. That is the setting in which God thinks it is the best place to put a child. When we develop the technology to produce children entirely in hospitals and leave them there for 20 years, that will not become the best place to raise children. God has deliberately put them in a marriage, in a family. And I think just some obvious consequences of that, it means that the aggressive end of child-led parenting cannot be the right thing. Again, that's not to prescribe, you know, when you let them cry and when you wake them up and whatever it is, but the family that revolves around the child cannot be the right answer biblically. The word obedience is there in verse 1. The word submit is there in chapter 5, verse 22. The word head is there in 5, verse 23. Obviously, this is not about child-led. But also, notice that the responsible unit here is obviously the parents for your child. And just to rule out some others, parent, not grandparent. It may take a village to raise a child. But what your village, again, is doing is advising you, even if the person in the village is the one who raised you. Advice can be very good. Particularly if you bring up a child in the East End of London, you just need to be very ready to say thank you for your advice. People on buses, people in the street, people whatever, thank you so much for your advice as you carry on doing what you had already decided was the right thing to do. Not the grandparents, not the local council, not the church youth worker, not the Council for Biblical Toddlers from the USA, whatever it is, the responsibility lies with the parents. But again, as we said, at its most profound, this is very, very important. What does your child need most from you? They need most from you time working on your marriage with your spouse. Isn't that a shocking thing to say? Doesn't it sound selfish? The best you could do for your child is less about them and more about us, because that is for them. No other voice is going to say that in society, are they? And again, let me just underline, it's not impossible to raise a child without a spouse. Not saying there are never times when it is safer to walk away from a marriage, but the stress of raising the perfectly stimulated, stretched, middle-class child against having a husband and wife who know each other and pray together, long-term, your child would rather have that than the thing that you are maybe pouring your time into because you feel you should. What does your child most need from you? Time working on your marriage with your spouse. And that is true in general, and it's also true in the specifics that are here for husbands and wives. So the husband is told to love their wife in the same way as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So that is what my children most need to see from me, what they most need in me, is to see me loving Claire and sacrificing myself for her, giving things up for her. And the wife is told, submit to the husband as to the Lord, and submit in everything as to their husbands as the church submits to Christ. And that is what a child most needs to see in the wife and mother. Partly because that will generate secure and stable homes. If God actually knows what he's doing and what God tells us to do is good, however hard they feel to do, then that will build the home the child needs. But also, if you think just of the specifics, think of a strong-willed child at age 2 or 12 or 22. When you ask them to live a different way from the way they want to, you are asking them to always, you're asking them to put other people ahead of themselves, stop hitting your sister. That is a request to put somebody else that you don't really care about ahead of yourself. Love your wife, not someone you don't really care about, shouldn't have said that. Love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for you. If the 2-year-old, 12-year-old, 22-year-old has seen you, husband, consistently give up things for somebody else, well, that will help them when you ask them to give up things for other people. Or when you ask a strong-willed child of 2, 12, or 22 to obey their parents or submit to the annoying teacher at school, despite how stupid and frustrating that feels, well, if they have consistently seen modeled submission, that is not a deletion of the opinion and will and spirit of the wife, but is, even when it feels stupid and frustrating, is a decision to submit in the way that Jesus asks you to, well, then that is going to help a child do that every time you ask them to. So set in a marriage. Point three, set in a church. And for this, I think you could write down chapter 2, verses 11 to 22, and also chapter 4, verses 1 to 16, though to be honest, that's maybe a bit arbitrary, and you can have lots of the rest of the letter as well if you want. What is this church thing that interrupts your family life on a Sunday and seems to absorb lots of your time? What is that and how good it is for your church? I just want to read bits of chapter 2. Imagine that you were an alien from completely outside of Christian things, and imagine that this was on a school letter with the heading "Exciting Opportunity for Your Child." The letters that say, some 18-year-old from the Guildhall School of Music is prepared to spend 10 minutes with your child. Fantastic opportunity. Okay, so imagine this was in the letter. Okay. So we're in chapter 2, and we'll say things like, he has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, making peace. Or verse 18, through him we both all have access in one spirit to the Father. It's a place where you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. Family trip to the palace to meet the Queen. That would be good. Sorry, school trip to the palace to meet the Queen. Built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. That beats any particular education theory or learning opportunity, doesn't it? The actual apostles and prophets are going to be there through their teaching. Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone. The whole structure joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord, being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit. We have a limited number of places, 10 places on offer. Your child can go there, be part of that. Wouldn't you think, I am going to stick 50p to the piece of paper and put it back in the envelope tomorrow morning, whatever else happens. Children set in a church, it's important, it's wonderful. And the mechanism of key importance comes up in chapter 4. It's there in verse 15 of chapter 4, that a church is a gym, is a place where the body is built until it is as good as Jesus. That's the goal. And it does that by normal Christians speaking the truth in love to each other. And verse 16, that's when every joint, every part makes the body grow. That happens as Christians speak the truth in love to each other. The fact that that is all of the membership of the church, that's why we invited godparents, grandparents, neighbours, uncles, aunts, please be here today. It's in fact a unique Christian privilege, actually. There are now zero contacts left where you can have intergenerational contact between children and other people. That is now almost illegal in every other setting, and yet is absolutely crucial for the good development of a child. But it only works if we all talk to each other in love from the Bible. And you think of the struggle to get to church, how hard it is in the first 6 months of a child's life when you barely can get three words with an adult at church, how hard it is when you have the worst behaved child in church. I think there's a particular responsibility that we have grasped with both hands to have the worst behaved child in church. I'm just surprised one of them isn't currently pushing the pulpit over from behind me. Maybe they are. And for this to happen, again, we need to take away the judgment and the prescription out of church. We need to be able to talk scriptural truths to each other without it being, I am a better parent than you. And every obvious Bible truth that I'm laying out in the next few minutes are just things that you could say to somebody at church tomorrow that would encourage them, that would help them. And also, we need to be able to talk about our problems and our failures in child rearing. Remember what the deputy head says, this is just what parenting is. So said in a church, and actually this applies to this point four, but applies to the marriage and to the church, is that it is made up of Christians. Obvious, you might think, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, material about what your child needs most from you. And here's something that comes even above your relationship with your husband or your wife. Your child needs most from you, your growth as a Christian. That is the most important thing they need. So just picking almost at random through these chapters for some verses that apply to us as parents. Let's look at some character things. Chapter 4, verse 31, 4, verse 32. Are those verses about parenting? No, they're not about parenting, but let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamour and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. Would somebody who was prayerful, repentant, committed, winning the hard yards in those areas of godliness, would they be a better parent? Yes. Wouldn't that make an enormous difference? More difference than quinoa, I think. Or verse 29, if this was how we spoke to and spoke about our children, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, so that it may give grace to those who hear. Would that help your child? Would that build your child up in family life? Or so much about what we're to know and live and do in practice. Maybe some of you have. It would be great, wouldn't it, to train our children selfishly to ask, have you done your quiet time, Daddy? Because the thing that will most benefit them is whether you have done your quiet time. It's good for them. You sometimes hear, don't you, parents saying, we just love Jemima more than anything in the whole world. And the right response is, I'm so sorry, poor Jemima, isn't it? The order here clearly is love for Jesus first, love for spouse second, child third, church fourth, and rest of life fifth. And that order is what is best for every single person in that order, not what is bad for them, but what is best for them through that. Okay, and then fifth point, which you'll see has a load of points under it, smuggled in. It is for those who are church, are married, those who are Christians who know the gospel. And the big prayer in Ephesians is for knowledge. Let me just read 1 verse 18 with a big kind of wind up. He then says, he's praying that having the eyes of your hearts enlightened, you may know the hope and the power. Or the other big prayer is in 3 verse 18, where again, with a huge wind-up, he's praying that you may have the strength not to make it through the night while you're feeding, but may have strength, though that's good too, strength to comprehend the breadth, height, length, depth of the love of Christ. So the big push in the book is that you would know. You can imagine God's heart saying, if only they could just grasp how much I love them. Just a small fraction of that. If only they could know how much power I have available to help them, that would really, really help. There's so much there. I'm just going to pick out a few things that we could talk about. And grace is the first one, but I'll go fairly quickly through all of them. Grace, you could write chapter 2, verses 1 to 10 in particular, though it floods across the whole letter. There is the right context to 6 verse 4. So the verse on parenting, it's about obedience and discipline, punishment even, for the child's sake. But the context is the family of God and how that father treats us. In fact, 3 verse 14 and 15 says that the father is the one from whom every family or every fatherhood, all fatherhood in heaven on earth, is named. And grace is obviously hugely important when we think about our failings as parents. What does God think of you as a parent? What do you do if for the last 5 years, last 10 years, you've not done anything in the way of Bible with your children, not done that every day? Well, tomorrow is a new day. And you have a God who is a God of grace, who will be delighted. The open arms of the father as the prodigal son comes home is also how he responds to prodigal parents as we go through. Think about that in terms of our failings. Think about that in terms of our children's sin. So I've specifically asked one of the people we're hearing from later today to talk about what you do if your children are badly behaved and sinful. Well, yes, consequences, yes, discipline, but behind all of it ought to be grace. That's the thing we most want children to know about us and from us, the sort of posture of grace, that we are waiting to forgive you. We are ready to forgive you, whatever it is you've done. That's the posture. Jesus has forgiven us, we forgive you. And also under grace, I think just to notice, you are an evangelist. In your family, with your children, tell them the gospel. Every opportunity, every chance, tell them the gospel. That's grace. Second one, sacrifice. And you could have that from all of chapters 1 to 6. I think in terms of Ephesians, there's a particular focus on holiness, isn't there? In chapter 4 and 5, and there's also a focus at the end of chapter 6 on fighting, wrestling against the devil and against sin and temptation, and also against a hostile world. In 6 verse 20, Paul is the ambassador in chains in prison for the gospel. So if you're a Christian parent who knows the gospel, then sacrifice is a normal part of a Christian family and built into the life of your child. So let's just think about some of these holiness things. Will you tell your child, for instance, the teaching in 5 verse 3, in a world now that says that it is repression not to do whatever you want sexually, and it is a huge sacrifice, particularly in a room this size when a number of our children, by averages, are not going to be kind of straightforwardly heterosexual, desiring the things that the Bible says that are the right place for sex. Are we going to be able to say to our children, actually sacrifice, even the areas of what we desire, is good? Is this a family rigged for sacrifice? With the positive of that. Here's a question that I heard Glenn Harrison ask that I've been rolling out in Central Focus and other places. We'll do it as an exercise because it'll give you something to do with your arm. It may do or may not. So Glyn's question is, raise your hand if during your childhood you heard a Christian parent or a Christian leader, teacher speak positively about sex. Raise your hand. Okay, and that was roughly the same result. So that's a slightly more positive result than every time I've seen him do that or I've done that. Was that 10% around the room, something like that? So again, sacrifice. The sexual teaching of the Bible is seen very much as sacrifice, but actually the sexual teaching of the Bible is wonderful, brilliant. And God thinks sex is wonderful and brilliant. And if you as a parent are not telling that to your child, well then, the sacrifice bit is harder. Sorry, I don't know how that got in on a sacrifice, but I think that's important. Under sacrifice, there is enormous pressure, isn't there, to give your child every advantage and comfort. And we will each feel that in different ways. It'll depend how we were raised. My mother-in-law is not a Christian and is very generous and is very focused on our children as she was on her children when she was raising them. And she would say that we have put church and God above our family in ways that are destructive and unhelpful. And in kind of discussing that round, I asked Ed, our youngest, what he thinks that might mean. And he mentioned the fact that in karate, which is his sport, all the fights happen on a Sunday. So everyone else in karate is learning fighting, and he is basically in a dance class. Because he can't fight. Not that he minds that particularly, but that's a cost. But I think my mother-in-law, she means living in London at all, living in East London in particular, children at state schools. My father-in-law once did say, over my dead body, will that happen? And he still breathes. Time that we're spending with people who are not our children and the volume of time we're spending with them, and what that means, I think, unsaid, but probably there is the earning potential that particularly their daughter could have had. But all of that, what are you doing making sacrifices on behalf of your children that they're not, you know, old enough to understand or talk about? Put that together with the general social pressure to give your child every possible advantage and comfort. What are you doing? Well, I hope what we're doing is we're teaching that this is a family that will take up our cross and sacrifice. And we need to be quite careful there. We're not just being selective. There is no excuse, is there, if all the sacrifices for Jesus always cost them, the children, and never cost me. You know, Jesus wants me to have lunch with Jim, but does not want us to go and see Frozen 2. That's not that's not sacrifice. But actually that being a Christian means you don't have all the advantages and comforts that other people do. That is basic gospel. You won't have all the opportunities that everyone else will have. You'll have hundreds of others, hundreds of fields and parents and mothers and brothers and sisters and children, but you will not have the opportunities that you could have had. That is just the gospel, isn't it? And I remember, I can't remember if it was 6 years ago or 10 years ago, I went to speak on 1 Corinthians 15 at the City Summer School, which, if you're one of the only people in the world hasn't been bored by me on that, it ends saying this life is your spare life and you may give up everything in this life for the sake of the real life you have to come in the future. And I'd been used to giving that to younger people without their parents present, so I developed a whole range of examples about, you know, you could get a less good degree and a less good job and a less good salary and a less good house and a less good pension. And, we, you know, there's quite a list that we've got used to trotting out. And I stood up and realized for the first time in my life I was going to say this to children with their parents present, and that was different. But I do believe it is true, and we said it anyway. Do you believe that your child's life is their spare life? Their life they're living now, their schooling, their training, their fun, their opportunities. Is this their spare life that they live here on earth with a better physical, bodily life to come in the future? And are you preparing them for that rather than now? Then I've got two more things to say, and we're very nearly out of time. sovereignty. Chapter 1, you will know, begins with a great deal about God being in charge. And all the way through the letter, there is lots about how big God is. So the question is, can we trust God with our children? Whenever William speaks on this, he always says to parents, don't keep digging up the roots to check how the plant is growing. And ultimately, that is a trust thing. You know, that's particularly about, you know, 20 questions with your child to see if they're still a Christian this week. Are you still a Christian? Whew, good. Rather than you plant the plant and you pour in the things the Bible says you should, and you tell them the gospel and you pray for them, and you trust that in 15, 20 years' time, you might have an idea whether they're Christian or not. And you trust God, he is sovereign. If he's sovereign, then the most helpful thing we can do for our child is pray. And again, just lay that alongside all the things that people around us stress about. Your child may or may not need Carol Vorderman maths, but she certainly does need you to pray. It also helps with humility, doesn't it? If you feel, I can't do this, well, that is entirely accurate. You cannot raise a Christian child, but God can. You can't convert anybody, but God can. Ephesians 2, they are dead. We were dead, and the power of God is to raise to life. So all of our hopes and fears for our children, for their lives, for our lives, and how our lives will be because of how their lives will be, God is the only one that actually has the power to do that. And he is good in good times and in bad, and we can trust him. He's sovereign. And then the final one is about eternity, which again, chapter 1, you'll know, begins before the creation of the world and presses on by the end in verse 22 into the end of the world, the age to come, where Jesus will rule and all things will be under his feet. And parenting, I think, like no other thing, shortens your horizon and fixes your eyes on the current crisis. What is your goal currently with your child? What are you currently praying for? I guess, if you like we were, your goal is that they would sleep, you know, for more than 1 hour in a go, or sleep through the night. Or your goal is that, you know, when it comes the next time we see grandma, they would behave better than they did on Christmas Day, you know, for at least some of it. Or your goal is to cling on until the wonderful day when school will take them away for hours of the day. Whereas the goal, actually, the horizon could be pushed far further out than that, couldn't it? The goal in this life is a godly Christian adult. That would be a better goal, wouldn't it? Which means things like them being able to make godly Christian decisions for themselves. And in student ministry, I often pick this up right at the other end of the scale, if you like, but with 22-year-olds, 21-year-olds, where parents were still incredibly stressed about the child making a decision for themselves, even on things where you think, okay, I might even be on the parent's side, but it's a 60-40 choice, really. Whereas actually, if your goal is a child who can make good decisions for themselves their whole life, the only way there is a whole load of mess as they make not ideal decisions on the way, isn't it? And there's judgment calls about where you put the freedom, but the goal is a Christian adult. You want a child with their own understanding of why Scripture is good for them and able to make their own understanding, their own reading of Scripture, able to work their way to their own conscience, feed themselves, all those things. Lay that alongside the things sometimes we worry about more. Will I have grandchildren? Will they have children? Will they marry? Will they be on their own? When actually, we've just been doing 1 Corinthians 7 in Central Focus. Seems to be saying it would be fine for our children to be single. Better for our children to be single. They could read the Bible. They could come to that decision. And that would be good. And the goal is a godly Christian adult. Would you rather have a heterosexual child or a child that loves Jesus and puts Jesus first? The things we panic about compared to the things that the Bible says are most important. But then let's push the horizon even further, because a godly Christian adult is still not the right horizon, is it? the right horizon is to be in eternity with our children. Want to be with Tom and Ed forever. And we want them, therefore, to trust Jesus throughout and die well. That's the goal, actually. Someone I was talking to last week remembered his school saying, everyone else will be preparing you to live well, every other school. We want you to die well. Isn't that a great goal? Slightly morbid. Well done, those with new babies. You've got you know, amazing new life. Your goal is for them to die well with Jesus, trusting Jesus, knowing where they're going, so that you can be with them for eternity. That's the real goal. Great. And as you take a seat, I'm going to begin introducing what we're doing next. We're very grateful to the seven people who are going to be contributing in the next hour. As I said, the pattern is that they will give us a bit of input from the front, and then again, with whoever you've been sitting with and discussing, you'll have 4 or 5 minutes talking about something that's been said or lodging things that need to be talked about later. The seven people have asked me to say that they are not experts, and again, we're not having them here to say this is how you must do things. Everything we said earlier today is still true, but on a variety of these topics, we thought it'd just be great to get some advice, some wisdom, some experience from them. So slot number one is about how to have conversations with your children. Tricky conversations, important conversations, and Brian and Clara Donoghue are going to come and talk about that. Parents to many, many, many children of such advanced age. One of them's even gone overseas on their gap year, so that is success, isn't it? So, Brian and Claire.
Claire, what are the general principles that we've used in having these conversations?
So we've got four children, Ella, who's 18, and then three boys who are 16, 14, and 11. And in terms of general principles, I'd say we've tried to create an atmosphere at home where they feel able to talk to us. So we've done this by making sure that we are engaging in things that they are interested in, listening well. And I find that's not always easy with three boys who are interested in things that I find really boring. So, it's wonderful. If your children like the things you like, then yeah, good for you. But I have had to work really hard at that. And so to find things that we can enjoy together so that we are talking about things together, whether that's films, I will sit down and watch films with them. We're really trying to fight against watching individual screens so that you're actually watching something together, talking together about characters, reading their books with them or on my own. So having lots of fun with them so that in the home, they feel able to talk to us. We've made sure that we're around with them so that we can do that. When there's something specific that we want to raise with them and talk to them, we thought we've probably tried to be intentionally unintense. And what I mean by that is that we'll have in mind something that we want to talk to them about and then find a time that's a really unintense time, like walking along with them to school, or in the car with them, or playing together, or cooking together, chopping vegetables, maybe doing chores, you know, making their beds or changing sheets, that sort of thing. And then, so it's an unintense time, but you have in mind something specific that you want to talk to them about. And then finally, we've made sure that we're always opening the Bible with them, and as we go through different books of the Bible, questions about Christian teaching naturally do come up. And often they're very small snippets of time, very, again, unintense. So it might be in the car on the way home from church, we'll just chat about what they've learned, or over Sunday lunch. Not lengthy, in-depth discussions, but little bit by little bit. Brian, over to you. Now, how we've been asked about the three particular specific issues. How have we talked to the children about sex?
I get the easy question. When they were young, we had the common sort of questions that everyone has about where do babies come from. We responded to that quite factually. No mention of the stork or the baby factory. We use proper terms for sexual organs rather than made-up names. That's how we did it. Actually, when we were chatting to the boys last night about doing this and what we were going to say, one of them nearly spat his food out. He was so horrified at the idea that we might be doing this. And then he admitted that for many years he thought babies came out of your mouth or your belly and you could choose which. So we'd obviously done a great job. As they got older, we knew they were being taught about sex at school, and they often, they much preferred to hear it from somebody they didn't know, so to speak, I think they would have found it hugely embarrassing to talk to us about it. However, we were aware that from either the school or from things that they just said in everyday conversations, that sometimes what was being taught wasn't the Christian view of sex. So we sought to address issues as they arose in conversation from reading books, from watching things with them, or just from their friends' slightly different family situations. So, you know, one friend had two mothers and that sort of thing. And we sought to talk to them about it, to direct them to what the Bible clearly says, to stress that God created sex, that he values it within the right context, that it's for our good, And that they shouldn't be surprised that the world's view of sex is different from what the Christian view of sex is.
Now, what about the internet as well? So slightly related.
Yes. Well, we've done the usual thing of setting safeguards, so no phones in bedrooms overnight, no disappearing off to a bedroom with a screen or anything like that. We've insisted that... as we're giving them the phone, that they're using our Wi-Fi, that we know the password for their phone, and that that's not something unusual for them. We try and reassure them we're not going to pry and read every single one of their messages or things like that. We're not going to send anything from their phone. But they know that at any time we could check it. And we've warned them individually and together about the dangers of the internet. And inevitably, we realise that our own personal experience of growing up very much in the analogue age is very different from theirs today. And it's very easy, I think, for us to be in the dark about what they're doing with their phone, what they're viewing or sharing on their phones, their computers, or their friends' phones or computers. We've had to respond to issues or questions as they came up. When one of them has done something foolish with viewing something inappropriate on the internet, I've, in that situation, spoken to them individually. I've tried not to show any shock or disgust. I'm conscious that they're already feeling hugely embarrassed or ashamed. And we've sought to help them to see the problem and how any such behaviour is inconsistent with seeking to follow Jesus. We've wanted them to repent, to change their behaviour, not just to express sorrow for being found out. We've sought to listen, not just to speak, and often that's been one of the more important times. We've talked to them about Christians living distinctively in the world, different from the world. We prayed with them for God's help and for self-control for them. And we've reminded them of real forgiveness in and through the Lord Jesus. And picking up on what Charlie said earlier, we've sought to reassure them of our ongoing love for them. There's often been sort of hugs involved and that sort of thing, and of our forgiveness for them. We've said we'd much rather they confess that they told us if they'd done something stupid than if we discovered it later ourselves. Claire, lastly, how have we spoken to them about conflict in family relationships?
We've got time for this one. So I guess there are different types of conflict. If they've had an argument with each other, which happens a fair amount, we've tried to talk to them individually, largely just to diffuse the situation and separate them and try and ask them what the problem is so they've got a chance to share their version of events, which usually is wildly different from their siblings' version of events. So it's often quite hard to work out what has gone on. We've therefore just tried to remind them of the need to be kind to each other, encourage them to resolve the conflict by saying sorry, forgiving each other. I mean, they're normal things, but it has been fairly ongoing. As they've got older, they've got a little bit better at sorting out that conflict with each other, but we've probably had to deal a bit more with backchat and rudeness towards us, and we try to present a united front. Children and teenagers especially quickly work out who is the weakest link, if there is one, and make the most of it. So, but mum said, and so we've tried to really support each other in front of the children and not allow us to speak to us or about either of us rudely. And then I guess there's also conflict created by us, which, you know, as you go on as a parent, you realise more and more that that is the case. This week, one of the boys greeted Brian with, "Oh, mum dropped a glass and screamed at us," you know, which was actually a fair version of the event. Often it is our fault, you know. And so we have spent a lot of time apologising to our children and repenting to them. And it's not always very pleasant. It's very humbling, but I think it's important if we're the ones who have started the conflict for whatever reason.
It's worth saying there was no alcohol in the glass at the time when she dropped it. It was just a glass. I think now we've got 5 minutes to talk to one another in our groups about how you would go about having these sorts of conversations.
So can I interrupt and introduce our second couple? So this is Jeremy and Dawn Hobson, who lead Trinity Church Islington. They are parents. Amy is 20 and Justin is 17. So again, at the getting their lives back end of that. And we have particularly asked them to talk about, I guess, raising your children in partnership with other people. So let me ask the first question, and I think that'll become obvious. So, Jeremy, I think particularly this one, but Dawn may chip in as well. Jeremy, what is the balance of responsibility and impact between church groups and summer camps? I first met Jeremy when I was 17. He was my leader on a summer camp. You can ask him about that in many ways. Church groups, summer camps, and parents, in terms of how Christian teaching and discipleship works. How's that worked in your family?
Thank you for asking. I speak as someone who became a Christian on summer camp. I've got a great deal of time for summer camps, and that was how I first came to the Lord. I wasn't really discipled in my home or at church, and the Lord very graciously kept me. That said, thank you for all that you said this morning, Charlie, and I'd like to endorse all of that. I think that that it's really camps number three, church groups number two, and parents number one. I think the Bible seems to teach that. And I think the Bible says that parents have a special responsibility for teaching the gospel to their children. In my quiet time this morning, Psalm 145, one generation commends your deeds to another. They tell of your mighty acts. And I think in our family, it's fair to say that we have quite an informal sort of ongoing relationship with our children. All kinds of questions come up. We're talking all the time about gospel issues. And I see that as one of my primary responsibilities. As a church leader, I need to be careful that I don't spend too much time discipling people outside of the home and not discipling people inside of the home. And like any discipling relationship, it's three steps forward and two steps back. So when Justin was three, we had an evangelistic tea for elderly people. This is down in Eastbourne. 20 people there who weren't yet Christians. And Justin walked in as a three-year-old, looked up and announced loudly, "I am a child of the devil." And that was a teaching opportunity. Yeah.
And I should just say,
is that working?
I don't
know. Yeah, okay.
I should just say that the older Christians who responded to that were so utterly fantastic that they reassured us in the gospel. They treated him with grace. They completely ignored that comment, rightly. And they were not at all thrown by it. And I think, in fact, one elderly lady actually said, "whatever" to him, which I just thought was brilliant. But teaching him that we're not just going to respond to what you've done wrong, we're going to treat you with grace. And they treated him with such grace. He came home with 22 Easter eggs that year.
Can I ask, Dawn, how have you worked with church groups? Any tips for us on making the most of church groups? What if the kids don't want to go? What have you done?
In God's sovereignty, we've been hugely blessed by the Christians who have been in Church Youth Group, who have been here for Bridge and Brunction. Will, we are so grateful to the Lord for you, discipling our son through incredible times. Thank you. I think we have, I mean, I echo the point about atmosphere at home, about discipling them, being willing to talk day by day, particularly as they go through teenage years. They're hearing things in the classroom. Coming back and discussing it, it's important not to be shocked. It's important to be willing to listen. And it's important then to have other adults who back up the Bible teaching that you're giving at home. Staying for a long time in our church family has been a great blessing from the Lord because...
You mean number of years or number of hours?
I mean a number of years, yeah. I'm afraid. A number of years because, for example, Justin and Amy have had key Christian adults in their lives who have seen them through 10 years of adolescence. And that has been an exceptional blessing. We've also been willing to allow other people to rebuke and challenge and train our children and to be honest when our children are having a harder time and asking for prayer and sharing that so that as the church family, people have partnered with us. I don't have a Christian family in my parents, and I've been exceptionally grateful for that. Yeah.
It might be worth saying about if they don't want to go. I think we've said to our children, we want them to come to church this until they're adults, until they're 18. But something that they've found helpful, I think, is they haven't always wanted to go out to the groups, and we've said that's absolutely fine. Sometimes they want to sit in and listen to the talk. And I think sometimes, you know, it depends on your child. Every child's completely different. But I think some children learn better in that sort of preaching environment than they might do in a youth group. And so we've let them lead that. And I think they've found that helpful.
And if they don't want to go out midweek, is that included in church? You've got to go, or it's...
No, we haven't. I mean, by God's grace, they have wanted to go midweek. And we've encouraged them to do that. But I think we've said that for them, we want them to be going with their church family on a Sunday. That's a minimum requirement for us as parents.
Yeah. Say a bit about inviting other children to church and making use of groups evangelistically. How have you done that?
We've had the incredible privilege of one of Amy's friends just started coming to our house every day and coming to school with her. They chatted on the bus, and Amy was struck by talking to this girl about the Lord, and so we prayed together as a family, so helping your child to pray for their non-Christian friend, to make that a focus of your prayer life together, and then coming round, being really warm and welcoming, they came round allowing Amy to go to their house as well, so that there was a building of trust that way, and then under God, she came to church, she became a Christian, praise God, and now she's leading her CU at uni, which is on the leadership team, but that's God's work, and beginning by praying with your children about their friends. Is that fair?
Yeah. And same thing, I guess, with summer camps. How have you made the most of summer camps evangelistically, or friends from different kinds of churches?
They have brought friends from other churches. Friends come from a local Pentecostal church recently, just a couple of weeks ago. Another friend came at Christmas from a Greek Orthodox church. And we've encouraged them to bring their friends along. I think the way we've tried to prepare Amy and Justin for camp is not just to see it as an opportunity to get good teaching, which they have, praise God, but also an opportunity to begin
That wasn't always the case, you know, that.
Well, I know. You and I, Charlie, know that that's not to be taken for granted. But I think as a safe environment for them to begin to reach their own generation, and they can reach their own generation in a way that I can't, for obvious reasons. And so we've encouraged them, if there are non-Christian, not yet Christian people in their dorms, to just begin to have evangelistic conversations, because it's quite a safe, contained environment for them to begin to do that.
Thank you. Anything else I should have asked you that I haven't asked you?
I think just one thing that is built on what you said earlier on, Charlie, which is constantly persuading them of and showing them the benefits of being part of a church family. Mm-hmm. I thought you explained that really well. I read somewhere that that the peak age for children to leave the church is between 15 and 18, But the time that they have decided to leave church is between 11 and 14. So it's never too early, really, to convince your children of the massive benefits of being part of a church family.
Thank you very much. Again, we're going to take 4 or 5 minutes talking about those things raised. Jeremy and John, thank you very, very much. Our next general speaker is Rob Scott, married to Becky, with children Susanna, Isabella and Isaac, and also a school governor. And we've asked Rob particularly to talk about school, how to think about being Christian parents to children at school, different school options, and also a bit about the way schools are heading on various topics, sex education things in particular. Rob.
In 7 minutes.
That's right.
I flew back from Bangladesh yesterday, so anything that is offensive or insensitive is due to jet lag. Anything that is helpful is due to caffeine. Becky's not with me this morning, not because she disagrees with what we're going to say. We've talked about it already. She's taken Isaac to play football at Hackney Marshes, although because it's a marsh, it's been waterlogged and rained off, so she could have been here. I was educated in state schools and a grammar school. Becky, my wife, was educated in private schools and a boarding school. I have family members who've been teachers in state schools. Becky's dad was the headmaster of her boarding school and became the director of Boarding Schools Association. Both of us are now more persuaded of the value of state schools and comprehensive schools over private schools and grammar schools, thinking they're good for the country and good for the gospel, recognising my real Christian brothers and sisters may disagree with us on this. How do we make our decisions on where our children have gone to school? Well, we tried to make them as Christians. We tried. As with any decisions, thinking who we are, with the gifts that we have, and particularly the money that we have, how can we put those to best use? Charlie, two autumns ago, was preaching, I think, on Luke's gospel, some application on money, and said, if you're having a kitchen extension, you can't give money to the gospel as much as you could have done before. So you might want to think that through. We were having a kitchen extension at the time. And we had thought it through, we hope, in Christian ways. And we can't give as much the gospel as a result of that. Hopefully we're more hospitable, but we do need to be hospitable. Similarly, if we wanted to send our children to private schools, we wouldn't have been able to give as much money to the gospel. We thought practically we could afford for one child to go, but we probably couldn't for the others, so that was an issue. We might get bursaries, but we might not, and they might not be through the whole school career. How do we deal with that? How would we manage our lives and income and work around that? We thought we'd put that to one side and went for state schools. Also, it's part of the focus that we have as a couple, me being on staff here, we're relating to the Bangladeshi community and trying to reach them, and so wanted our children to be where they are. Tim Chester's book, which is over there, called Gospel Centered Family, was also helpful for us. Just on the back it says, we're not just making good citizens, but also church planters, missionaries, reformers, servants and evangelists. This book challenges us to give up our respectable middle-class idols and to be the distinctively different people that God, through his gospel, calls us to be. And we wanted our children to join with us in our mission to Bangladeshi people. Friends, real friends, not imaginary friends, who are believers, would disagree with me. If they go for homeschooling or Christian education, they want their children to be missionaries post-school. They think it's dangerous for them to be missionaries in school. We disagree. We have different choices in that, but we both want our children to be missionaries in every sense of the word in the future. At the time that we were thinking about school education, there were quite a few graduates from Oak Hill Theological College come back quite fresh and challenging on homeschooling and Christian education and what that is about. And that got us thinking about these things. We'd never thought about them before, and it was good to process it all. Why are we not going to homeschool? Why are we not going to send them to a Christian school? At the time, the London Christian School was being set up. It was very attractive. If it had been on the north side of the Rotherhithe Tunnel rather than the south side, I think we would have sent them there because it would have been a great vehicle, instrument for mission in the local community. But we didn't. We sent our children to the local Church of England primary school, which we thought would be a good place for us to be involved in mission in the community. it wasn't a good school. It wasn't an outstanding school. It was satisfactory, according to Ofsted. So we were quite tentative about sending them there, because as important as mission and ministry is, school is also about education. Our children did make good progress there, so that kept us happy, and so it made it less difficult for us to keep them there. If they hadn't made good progress, I think we'd have found it harder. The girls are now at all-girls comprehensive school, Church of England Comprehensive School in the centre of London, and the boy, he's at a local comprehensive school. Charlie mentioned about school gate evangelism. How is it? It's as hard as any other kind of evangelism, I think. We chose a primary school that's very close to us, so we walk past the people that are going to school at the same time. We see them in the community all the time. It's not just the school gate, which is great. We're sharing our lives with people, but we have to be proactive. Just being in the playground doesn't make evangelism happen, sadly. If you have more than one child, you're likely to be related to that primary school for more than 10 years, which is a great thing. Realistically, we've seen no fruit come from conversations we've had with numerous parents and families, but we hope and pray that God might work through that. As the children have got to secondary school, they're more involved in evangelism themselves, particularly in RE and in history lessons, both of which really encourage conversation and debate and discussion. Isaac, our son, this week was asked by a Somali boy, "So why do you say Jesus is the Son of God then?" Isaac tried answering that question. Within about 20 seconds, the Somali boy said, "Stop waffling. You Christians, all you do is waffle. You speak waffle." Isaac was a bit upset and taken aback by that, but wonderfully had the presence of mind to say, "If I'd asked you about Muhammad and you'd started explaining and I'd stopped you and said, 'You're just waffling,' what would you say?" Just to get him to think about what he was saying and how he was relating. I think that was great. But what was even more encouraging was that he talked with Becky about this. We've all been talking about the importance of talking about these things with our children as parents, and he was wanting to talk about it in his upset, and had he got it wrong, what could he do better next time? Should he just not say anything at all? And just talking that through was great, and we want him and our girls to keep talking about these things together. Our girls have got a bit of a reputation at school for being robust in religious education lessons. We get told that in the parents' consultation. They said, "Is that a problem?" They said, "No, as long as they stay respectful." So that's what we try and teach them, to be respectful in their robustness. And parents' evenings are great for showing where our children are getting it from to the teachers. They might have all kinds of impressions of who we are. So to talk about these things with parents is a great opportunity. The teacher's a great opportunity. And more specifically, on relationships and sex education within schools, you've probably heard a lot about it. I've tried to put a handout on it, which you can get at the back later. Relationships and sex education is to be taught in all primary and secondary schools, in all state and private schools. We need to recognise we live in a plural society. There are many different people in our society. But there's always a danger of recognition becoming promotion, and we need to be aware of that. We need to be aware, too, that the agenda behind it isn't necessarily bad. It's about safeguarding. It's learning the right anatomical words for bits and pieces. So when a child says something, a teacher can understand what's going on in their home life. It's about respect and preventing bullying. And as Christians, we should be at the forefront of that in many ways. In my all-boys, largely white school of 800 people, we were racist, Islamophobic and homophobic. I was. And this is a good set of teaching to challenge that. And as Christians, we shouldn't be those phobic people. Probably more worrying in some ways is not this RSE curriculum itself, but the wider curriculum, particularly in primary schools, how things might get taught just through general story time. And so you want to ask teachers, what stories are they reading and why, and talk it through. And no school is going to want to impose an RSE curriculum that winds up its parents. In Tower Hamlets, it's great. We have lots of Muslim parents. That can cause problems in Birmingham, as you've seen. But we have a common goal in many ways of bringing our children up within a certain set of values, morale-wise, morally-wise. And schools are going to be stupid to just go against that. Schools aren't going to want to upset people, and they should consult on these issues particularly. part of what's going on in my mind, and I think probably some of our other Christian parents' minds, is fearfulness. A lot of parenting does seem to be, in my mind, about fear. I'm scared for my children a whole lot of the time, and I want to protect them too much. I think RSE can be part of that as well. And we should recognize that all law, all curriculum, is someone's idea of morality imposed on someone else. As Christians, we've been in the ascendancy for many years and have been imposing ours on others, and we're just getting some of it back. And that can make us quite fearful and discomforted. And actually, when it comes to it, the Christian Institute have put out some very helpful things to say, and they're saying it's the whole RSE thing is not as bad as you think, and the law is protective of us and our values. But there's more on the handout. Could say a lot more generally about how we might support Christian teachers in our schools, about how being involved in a Christian union and setting it up, but there isn't more time. Why not talk with your spouse or anyone else that you want to about these things? How will you make your choices about a primary school or a secondary school or no school at all? How will you help your children to be Christian at school or at home? How might you engage with your school on issues like RE and RSE? A few minutes on that.
Good. While they're coming up, Rob's handout will be, where will it be? It is on the bookstall there. There's enough for everyone to grab one of those. It covers your rights as parents, the legal changes, lots of helpful suggestions on engaging with school, and some other resources to click onto, put together by Rob and by Ruth Gaved, who you'll know is a qualified teacher and now on the apprenticeship scheme here. So please grab one of those each as you go. Ali and Mary are here. They go to Crossway Stratford, where Ali is one of the elders. They have children at the younger end. So Isla is 6, Susanna is 4, and Cara, I said that right, Cara is 1.
Not Cara.
Because of the Scottish accents you're about to hear. So grew up in sort of small town suburban Scotland, but have arranged their lives in central London for the sake of ministry. And that's the topic we're going to talk about here now. How have they done that and why? So just tell us your current setup and how you've made those decisions.
So we live in Stratford, so pretty central London, well, East End, and right in the middle of a sort of booming, very busy part of London. We live in a terrace house. It's a real blessing. We've got a little bit of a garden as well, but it's quite small. We send our kids to the local primary school. I've made a similar decision to Rob and Becky on that. We're trying to do as much of a sort of inner London lifestyle and get everything as local as we can in the way we set stuff up.
And I guess Alistair is a barrister, so he's working in Temple, but is able to kind of be around in the morning, just about get home for bedtime, even though he sometimes brings stuff back. And I'm at home with the girls at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And how have you made the decisions? How have you decided more in general in life? How do you decide what to say yes to, ministry things or other things you're being asked to do?
So this question made us laugh because you basically say yes to almost everything.
So if you need anything done, just this.
We try to be really involved in church, and being a bit more locally based does help with that. One of the reasons we chose to try and stay central London is that I don't have a long commute. I mean, no people that made that work, but for us that was quite an important decision, so that I am around beginning and end of the day for the kids, and it's easy to get to small group and be kind of do stuff with people locally. It's a bit funny. Go on.
Well, I was going to say, I encourage Ali to declutter his responsibilities a little bit. So then you say, if you're going to be a trustee of the LCF, then you have to stop being
what's the LCF?
Oh, the Laura's Christian Fellowship. Then maybe you should let go of like mentoring some 17-year-old kid on an access scheme to law, and someone else could maybe start doing that. You know, just as you take on more, there are a few things at the other end that have had to start going.
Yeah, and I think that's, so we do try and say yes to quite a lot of things, but we have done that sort of, as one thing becomes more of a good opportunity at this time of life, we've tried to drop something else. So for instance, I used to try and go along a lot to the lunchtime talks, to like Fleet Street talks, which is the closest one to me. I haven't for a few years, not because it's not great, it's wonderful, but just it's one thing too many. And actually it's more important for me to have lots of time and energy for stuff for family and local ministry opportunities than that at the moment.
Yeah. And just pushing us on that, so if you sold your current house and bought in Scotland, sort of near the Clyde, what, you would get a much bigger house?
About four times as big.
So what? Why live where you are? What? How? And have you had to negotiate that with parents or?
Well, I think it's funny. I mean, my parents, I think are starting to understand London, but it used to be when they came down to visit us, they used to go and stay in nice hotels in places like Marylebone and would walk around and be like, oh, this is nice, why don't you move here? And they sort of slowly been educated to how realistic it is. But it's also, I mean, we're excited to live in the East End, actually, not just because it's the way that God's lined up for us, that's where we've had a chance to go and do lots of great ministry, but also I think some of the things that people worry about raising kids in central London, I think with a bit of thought and a bit of experience, we've started to think are real advantages. So for instance, the fact that it's hugely diverse in terms of religion and worldview and race and everything, it is scary for some people, but I think we've found it's actually really exciting. So it means that your kids are coming across a lot of these things really early, really young, when they're kind of a bit very much safe and willing to listen to what mummy and daddy think and kind of be trained and instructed in that. And also, it's okay to be weird, right? Because everybody's weird. So for instance, when Isla was, it was Halloween time, she would trot off to school and people were seeing all this Halloween stuff. And some of the Muslim kids in her class were like, oh, well, we don't do Halloween. So she trotted back to home and sort of talked to us. And we were like, well, no, we're Christians. We don't do Halloween either. So she goes back to school and says, I'm a Christian. We don't do Halloween. And that's just totally normal. That's fine. There's very little kind of total peer pressure because there's so many different cultures at school and in their friends that it's okay to be different.
And I think that is amazing. Like someone else said that to us, if your kids grow up as teenagers, they come across all these different ideas while they're still under your roof and hopefully they're still talking to you about those things. And yeah, just particularly the freedom not to have this one culture where everyone does Santa, everyone does Halloween. You know, you can choose. In fact, yeah, a little Muslim kid said, oh, we don't celebrate Christmas, but we do still get presents. And I just love that distinction. Like, yes, you and like all of our secular culture don't actually celebrate Christmas and Jesus' birth, but you do get presents and have the trappings. And I think for kids, like five-year-olds, seeing that distinction is great, isn't it?
Thank you. And again, just pushing on something. So I happen to know some of what these guys do. So being an elder presumably takes a lot of time. I'm aware of a variety of people who will ask a barrister for free advice and get it. You're on the Human Rights Commission Council.
Equality and Human Rights Commission.
Equality and Human Rights Commission. So in terms of some of the stuff on this handout, having a Christian on that body is enormously important. But there are decisions there all the time. I also know that you thought very seriously about full-time ministry. I went to a wedding once and a minibus of people had arrived all together. And on that minibus, Ali had preached. Is that, that's right? You'd done a sermon, you were getting ready for the day after. And people came off the bus one by one saying, if any of us should be in full-time ministry, Ali should. But you've decided for now anyway to be a barrister. Just how are you juggling weighing?
So I think, I mean, it's a really good thing, as hopefully we all think, that if you've potentially got the gifts and people are saying to you, you might be able to do full-time ministry, to really think about it seriously. But I think the answer might be no, because there are other opportunities, and that's the conclusion we've come to, at least for the moment. I love the law. I know that's a weird, geeky thing to say, but I actually do. I enjoy it, and it's given me... So at the time we made this decision a few years ago, I was starting to get quite a lot of opportunities to try and be quite a distinctive Christian voice in a lot of sort of legal policy type things, public policy type things. And sort of we made the call basically, I'm going to stick with this because I think I'm getting these kind of opportunities. And also because actually we could do a huge amount of ministry without doing it full time in a paid role. And we found that even more actually being in a church plant. There's just a lot of stuff to do and we can do a lot. It helps that I'm self-employed and I'm a bit flexible. But I think so far, God seems to have confirmed that decision in what's come up. So in the last 3 or 4 years, I have had suddenly these pretty massive opportunities like the commission to use the skills I've got and the gifts and opportunities I've been given to use in this space. And I think we're excited by that. And we encourage other people to think through those possibilities as well as they think about ministry and full-time ministry.
And it does mean Ali's getting to do cases about these kind of like freedom of conscience and belief, like protecting Christian values, but also like you're representing a Muslim who was also concerned about the kind of sex ed stuff, and it got into trouble with her employment body. And I think it's amazing. It is exactly the kind of stuff you wanted to be able to be doing and kind of hold open that space that we're also fearful about, but actually there is a lot of freedom, and you've been able to be part of articulating that.
And then last question, just a bit more about your local ministry opportunities for you, your family, your children, I guess school things particularly, but you've rigged your life to stay in London, stay in central London for ministry. Give us a flavour of how that's going.
Well, just recently I've been able to get involved, and Jennifer, a few of the rest of us at Crossway as well, have been involved in this charity that is just in Newham called Faith in Schools, which is basically a Christian parent 15 years ago said to her at the school her kids were at, I could come and do some of your RE provision for you. And now they're in half of the primary schools in Newham, so they're in 42 schools doing pretty much, they're in kind of every year group, every term, in the classroom for an hour with the kids, teaching on like communion and baptism, or like why is the Bible important to Christians? And it's really good stuff. And so I had the opportunity to start to get involved. It's something I'd like to do a bit more of. I've got small children still at home, but I think that's very exciting in and of itself. Connecting with the kids in the classroom is different from assembly, but I think it's very good. And also it's helped with just parachurch. I feel like we're just finding our feet in knowing the other local churches who are also evangelical, keen on getting the gospel into schools, keen on doing things. So we did a Christmas thing together, and that was brilliant. That was kind of five of us and getting to know like the other ministers' wives and stuff like that. And that felt very positive, like partnering with people who also want to speak the gospel in the community. So that's big. And also we don't have a play group because we're a small church plant we're not too small, but without a building. But that does mean we've just gone together to support other local play groups. And particularly one of our girls was working for London City Mission and setting up a play group in Forest Gate, so we all could kind of get behind that. So there's loads of stuff to do, yeah.
The other exciting thing that's just sort of started is we're exploring the possibility of trying to set up a Christian free school. So a government-funded school with a Christian ethos in East London. For secondary. And that's, again, hopefully, if it works, a great opportunity to get the gospel out, but serve the local community, help people stay in central London as well. So in fact, if anyone's interested in that, come and talk to us. We'd love to tell you more.
And this is good. We wanted different parents to do different things, so there's the slightly Christian school option.
Yes.
So good. I think, thank you so much. For sake of time, I'm going to pause it there. Again, take 3 or 4 minutes together talking about, and I guess we're all at different stages and currently still in London, making London possible for ministry long term potentially would be a great thing to chat about, particularly. Yeah, thank you very much indeed. Please go straight from that into praying. So the next thing we're going to do, I don't think I'll stand up again, please go straight from that into praying. You may want to pray just as couples, or in your small groups, you may want to combine with the people next to you.